commercial whaling was a global industry, and it was a global industry 200 years ago. The year on record that more whales were hunted and killed commercially was 1956. So relatively recent history. Project Jonah is a marine mammal welfare organization that here in 2024, we've just reached our 50th anniversary. We've been most famous for being a volunteer organization that founded in that the early 1970s, at a time where human societies were starting to see the negative impacts we were having on our environments, and in particular the marine environment. We started in that campaigning and awareness. That was where we started. But today I describe Project Jonah as a marine mammal welfare. We've got it narrowed down to about 18 different reasons that the stranding may have occurred. And it's usually a combination of factors. Sometimes it can be as simple as a whale has reached the end of its shelf life and it has died of old age. Often they can be avoiding predation, and even high and low weather pressure that can and weather fronts that can actually lead even our migrating species, that can lead them to be pushed off of course or off of their usual migrating stream, and that can bring them closer to shore, and then that can lead to strandings as well. So you've got these kind of natural reasons, but of course then you've got the anthropogenic, the human reasons, whether that is noise in the oceans, whether that is interactions, a whale or dolphin could get injured as a result of interaction with a vessel. Historically, if we go back over our stranding database, it does show that strandings occur more frequently during the summer months. However, last few years, that predictability, as useful as it is, it's not happening anymore. Speaking to our peers, speaking to scientists, and it's simply down to warming oceans. And our warming oceans as a result of anthropogenic climate change.
Hello, kia ora.
And welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast.
We're your hosts. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna. And today we are joined by Darren Grover from Project Jonah. Kia ora, Darren.
Kia ora, korua.
It's so good to have you here. We're so excited to talk about marine mammal strandings and what is happening in Aotearoa, New Zealand to change that. So would you like to start by introducing yourself and Project Jonah?
Certainly, yeah. I'm the general manager of Project Jonah. Project Jonah is a marine mammal welfare organization that here in 2024, we've just reached our 50th anniversary.
Congrats.
I've been involved with Project Jonah for about a quarter of its lifetime. I'm an employee, but we've been most famous for being a volunteer organization that founded in that the early 1970s, at a time where I think most of human societies were starting to see and observe the impacts, the negative impacts we were having on our environments, and in particular the marine environment. And so that early 1970s was a key period of time of that growing awareness. And people who cared about specifically whales and dolphins, they formed under the banner of Project Jonah. And here we are now, 50 years later, still flying that flag and working as hard as ever, and hopefully honouring the work that they did way back then.
First of all, thank you for introducing yourself, but also happy 50th anniversary. To me, that's always a milestone if a, volunteer, hugely volunteer-based organization reaches that. That is absolutely amazing. Can you give us a brief history, diving into the history a little bit deeper than you have in your intro, please?
Commercial whaling was a global industry, and it was a global industry 200 years ago. And in fact, not long after the European explorers were landing on the shores of Aotearoa, New Zealand, pretty much following very closely behind them were commercial whalers. And the commercial whalers integrated into New Zealand society. And Māori people also got heavily involved with commercial whaling as well. And there was a saying in the late 1700s that on every successful whaling ship, there was at least one Māori, because they were the best at spotting the whales and they were the best at leading out the rowing boats out to the whales and harpooning them. However, the year on record that where more whales were hunted and killed commercially was 1956. So relatively recent history. I always think of commercial whaling as those large sailing ships and rowing harpoon vessels. But 1956, New Zealand, you know, maintained a very successful commercial whaling industry. We had, you know, our coastal waters and our economic zone was filled with so many whales. And that industry actually was quite a forward-thinking industry. It was regulated just after World War II in the late 1940s. It was regulated by a global body called the International Whaling Commission. And representatives of each country who wanted to conduct commercial whaling, they would go to an annual meeting, and there each of the countries would vote on which whales could be hunted, where they could be hunted, how many could be hunted, by whom. And New Zealand had a government representative that went to these meetings as well. However, in December 1965, the very last whale was hunted and killed commercially in New Zealand. That industry was no longer financially viable. We had over-harvested to the point that whales and dolphins were rarely seen close to shores here in Aotearoa. So no more commercial whaling, no need for a government representative to go to those meetings. However, in the early 1970s, there were a series of global oil shocks, and it was thought that the mineral oil that we were digging out of the ground and we were using to light our homes and power our vehicles, and had replaced the need, that strong need for whaling. It was believed this mineral oil was running out. And so in national news and then in international news, there were more and more stories of restarting commercial whaling. Well, this coincided with that period of time where humanity was starting to see the negative impacts on our environments, particularly the marine environment. And so a group of people formed under the banner of Project Jonah, and they were calling on the government for one specific thing, and that was to employ a representative and to send that representative to the International Whaling Commission annual meetings and vote against commercial whaling and obviously not restart commercial whaling here in New Zealand. And in 1976, our government did just that. And here in 2024, our government still has a representative that goes to those annual meetings and votes against commercial whaling. So that was our original foundation, but we were still seeing whales and dolphins stranding on our shores, and often as a result of human impacts. And so knowing how few whales and dolphins there were, and knowing that we were still having direct impacts on them, the movement that had formed under our banner, they called for legal protection for marine mammals. So whales and dolphins and some seals were already had legal protection. And in 1978, we were one of the first countries in the world to have full legal protection for marine mammals. And that includes rules around even how close you can get to them, whether you're out on a boat on the ocean, how close you can get to them, how you might interact with them. And even if you find there is one stranded on your local beach, you know, there are actually laws around how close you can get to them. And so we started in that campaigning and awareness. That was where we started. But today I describe Project Jonah as a marine mammal welfare. During, after those two successes, we were still seeing strandings occur, live strandings were occurring. And those live strandings, people would turn up. They were drawn to them, just as people are drawn to strandings today. Back then, people were drawn to them. But again, they had no understanding of what to do. And so some of our founders had worked with marine mammals in captivity and even in the act of catching the whales for captivity. But those people, they actually wanted to try, and they sought permission to try things, to try and ease suffering and maybe even prolong life and return whales and dolphins to the ocean. And over a period of several years, up until the mid-80s, we learned a lot of things. We learned some good things. We also learned some bad things, but that's good. So we don't do those anymore, and we realize the negative impacts those actions have. And then we formed the knowledge that we have today, and we were real trailblazers back then. You know, we were the first organization in the world to be doing this, and we have built this knowledge. It's we now have public training courses where members of the public can learn this knowledge, and we share this knowledge with other groups who have formed since around the world. And so that's how I describe us today.
Right. So you've evolved from a world where whales, hunting them was just the norm, to that being outlawed. Project Jonah played a pivotal role in voting against commercial whaling. And I guess what you're saying is that the need for the need for help with strandings led to curiosity, and that curiosity evolved into training programs. I wasn't aware that Project Jonah was a first in the world to provide these training programs, which is really cool. Clearly, very innovative organization. But if we look at the missions of Project Jonah today, what is it that you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, a day-to-day basis is, it could be anything or everything. It depends. If the phone rings and there is a stranding, then everything gets dropped to respond to that stranding. And that might possibly be staff mobilizing and going directly to a beach, or it might be us working and reaching out to our network of trained volunteers and mobilizing them. But when we're not responding to trainings, we are a very small charity. We have 2.5 full-time staff and a few contractors, and we're always delivering on our visions of rescue, action, and protection. So today you find me in the office. Obviously, I'm talking to yourselves. I'm sharing our knowledge. I'm working to engage more people with our cause and with awareness of the marine environment. But like any small organization, there are the day-to-day operational elements that need to be done. So yeah, I've spent time answering people's emails. I've spent time engaging with suppliers. I've spent time helping arrange some of the necessary venues for our future training courses. So it's a real mixed bag what we do. While we have a few staff and we can call on volunteers to respond to strandings, volunteers also help in so many ways with that administration and with that operational delivery of what we do too. So yeah, so you find me right there in this sweet spot. I was working half of my Saturday in mobilizing and responding to a stranding in Golden Bay here in the South Island.
Far out. So as I understand it, you've trained volunteers all over the country on how to respond to strandings because people care, like they genuinely want to be there to help stranded marine mammals. And now you're in a position as an organization where you continue to train new people, but also can mobilize networks and communities around the country when strandings happen and as a needed basis. And then on top of that, you look after ensuring that essentially the voice for marine mammals educationally and advocacy is there. Is that about right? Or
oh yeah, if you want to sum it up in a nutshell, yeah, that's pretty much us. We not only do we train adults, we also train we have a schools education program, and we have several volunteers and short-term contractors going into our major towns and cities and talking to them about whales and dolphins, but not just the whales and dolphins themselves. We also talk about their environment and the impacts we can have on their environment, both good and bad. And then that can then lead people to making choices and making decisions in their day-to-day lives about, hopefully having a positive impact rather than a negative impact.
Yeah, I think education sits at the center of everything that we do and don't do. And it's so cool to see that that's on top of the marine mammal courses, starting that at a young age. But coming back to the marine mammal strandings that you deal with, what are the most common causes that we know of for these events to happen in the first place?
Oh gosh, that's a very good question. And when people find out what I do for the first time, they usually ask, why do whales strand? We've got it narrowed down to about 18 different reasons that the stranding may have occurred. And it's usually a combination of factors. Sometimes it can be as simple as a whale has reached the end of its shelf life and it has died of old age. All animals do. And whales and dolphins, when they die, they're very buoyant. Biologically, they do float on the surface for several days. And then depending on currents and wind, they can end up washing up on the beach. And so with those commonly occurring stranding is what we call beach cast. And that is cast upon the beach after dying. And that's often single strandings as well. However, New Zealand, we're famous for having what's been described as a whale trap here in the top of the South Island at Farewell Spit in Golden Bay. And the geography of the bay there, you have a very, very gentle shelving beach, which is sandy bottom as well. And often we see pods of migrating pilot whales coming between the Cook Strait, between the North and the South Islands of New Zealand. They come into Golden Bay because it's a calm area with lots of good food for them. But what happens is as they're swimming in that bay, they use their echolocation to see the depth of the water. But what they can't see is that they are getting closer and closer and closer to shore because it's so gently shelving there. In fact, the distance between high tide and low tide can be more than 5 kilometers in places.
Wow. Yeah.
And so a whale, in fact, a whole pod of whales could be in there, could be chasing squid, getting a good feed. And before they know it, they've got into a meter or even less than a meter of water, but that tide's on the way out and they're unaware of that. So they can quite simply be, as a sad stroke of luck, the geography there catches them out. But of course, what that can lead to is a pod of pilot whales can be many hundreds of individuals. And in 2017, we had one of the largest strandings in more than 100 years there. Over 600 individuals across 3 days stranded in the bay. Often they can be avoiding predation. We often find dolphins or individual animals can end up in unusual places. They can end up in marinas, or they can end up in very shallow river, or not even river mouths, almost like little streams. They can end up there. And often they're fleeing what they perceive as the threat of predation. Now, we have some... We have our own population of orca here in New Zealand, but orca are known as the killer whale, and that is because they will kill other whales. That means that often if you see orca around, then chances are you're not going to see any other dolphins and whales, usually. But also orca being nearby can mean individual whales or even pods of whales and dolphins have been displaced and they end up in these unusual places and even stranded as well. And even high and low weather pressure that can and weather fronts that can actually lead even our migrating species that can lead them to be pushed off of course or off of their usual migrating stream, and that can bring them closer to shore, and then that can lead to strandings as well. So you've got these kind of natural reasons, but of course then you've got the anthropogenic, the human reasons, and whether that is noise in the oceans, whether that is physical interactions, a whale or dolphin could get injured as a result of interaction with a vessel, and then an injured whale or dolphin, if it's unable to swim against tides or unable to choose where to swim, it's that badly injured, it will end up coming to shore if it is, within several kilometres of shore. And then you've got indirect human impacts. So things like overfishing in a locality, whales and dolphins can, some species can go many, many days and weeks without the need to feed. But if there is very little fish in an area, they will eventually become emaciated, become sick, become tired, and end up stranding as well. And then you've got interaction with the vessels who are doing the fishing too. So there's some of the reasons there. And of course, let's not forget, natural illnesses. They get diseases, diseases like tuberculosis. And we're talking about avian bird flu. There's a worry that marine mammals, it's already been seen in seals. There's a worry that this might start to impact in the coming months and years our marine mammal populations too. So that kind of covers a majority of the reasons why. And as I say, it can be a combination of 2, 3, 4 factors or even more. And sometimes we never know.
Wow, that's so fascinating. Just a side question that came up as you were explaining the factors that lead to a whale stranding. The one you mentioned with the whales stranding in Golden Bay near Farewell Spit as a result of the geography made me wonder, are you aware of any research or any kind of stories about how whales might teach their children and teach their siblings and their family about potential strandings? Like, for example, in the Golden Bay area, would there be a case of whales teaching the next generation, avoid this area because of this danger, or in a rough weather pattern, look out for this? I know there's stories of orca teaching their children how to hunt by playing around with seals, and stories of other large intelligent animals doing as such. Is that a case here?
With our pilot whales, we hope that some of the ones that have stranded and we've been able to assist returning them to the ocean, they have got off and told the other members of their pods and any others they interact with. I hope they do, but they do still strand. So maybe the message isn't getting through. I think probably the best example of that knowledge sharing is our humpback whales and the humpback whales who have these massive migrations from Antarctica. So So just as we move into our summer months here, they're in Antarctica and they are feeding and gorging themselves on krill and schools of bait fish before taking these massive journeys up past our shores to then gather in the tropics. They spend winter up there in Niue and Tonga and Kermadec Islands. And if they up there, they'll be breeding or they'll be birthing. And so if they birth, then that calf will be with them for this entire migration cycle. So they'll be teaching them the safe places to gather with the same species. They'll be showing them the safe migration passageways and where to go and where not to go along the New Zealand coast. And then, of course, there's the safe feeding grounds as well. And so there is this cultural passing on of knowledge that we do see. And you mentioned orca as well, and some of the communicative and cooperative hunting that has been captured on camera is incredible. Yeah, sadly, our pilot whales don't tend to be getting the message there at Golden Bay. And Golden Bay is one of three areas. There's an area in Japan, and then there's Cape Cod in the United States, which are very, very similar in the geographical shape, which does tend to catch marine mammals out. Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Well, that's super fascinating. And you have to wonder, what it is about those locations that makes it so tricky for them to navigate. But other than by cause, do you categorize strandings by numbers or species or anything like that around here as well?
We call a mass stranding. A mass stranding is really kind of three or more individuals that are all involved in the same event. So if there's three or more whales or dolphins stranded on the beach, that's a mass stranding. One and two is usually a single stranding. But then, of course, you know, the event itself, even with 50 whales on the beach, is a single stranding. So defined as mass. And then you've got species-specific stranding. And here in New Zealand, we have one of the most endangered species in the world, our Maui dolphins, part of the Maui and Hector's dolphin. And of course, if one of those strands on the beach, then that is it's the highest priority response. So perhaps we have them categorized, you know, in that way. Other than that, in my mind, you've got different species that strand. And we know from our experience with pilot whales and with dolphins that generally they're able to survive a couple of refloat opportunities. And they're quite robust. And as long as their underlying health is okay, and if it's one of those reasons that isn't health related as to why they have stranded, then we know there's a good chance of us refloating them, returning them to the ocean. However, when we're working with our deeper ocean living species, there's several species of beaked whales that are quite common stranders here in New Zealand. And we also have our pygmy sperm whales, which indirectly related to our sperm whales, but sperm whales that grow 15 to 18 meters long, our pygmy sperm whales are 2 to 4 meters long. Wow. But again, very deep ocean living species and species that often live, you know, way out to sea. When these strand, they are out of their natural environment. They are not used to coastal waters. They're not used to tides and currents. And so when those strand, often the outcome is that they die. Often the outcome is we respond, we refloat, they turn around, they return, they refloat, they return. They do not go back into the ocean. And often they don't survive for very long. They might only survive maybe 6 to 12 hours maximum. Whereas, as I say, you know, I've been at a pilot whale stranding where we've tried five high tide refloats. So over 5 days, we have attempted a refloat. And on that fifth refloat, after 5 days, pilot whales have returned to the ocean.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. And I guess it makes sense, coastal versus deep sea, that there's differences, because I guess when they strand, they're putting themselves totally out of the environment they're evolved to live in. So would it be fair to say that once a stranding occurs, we're kind of on a timer a little bit because of that?
I don't want to say that, because that can often lead to people responding with haste. And responding with haste is often not the thing we want to have happen with a marine mammal. It does put the pressure on with regards to those deep ocean living species. But again, we still want to assess their health, and we still want to see whether they are indeed candidates for a successful refloat. Because what we want to do, you know, if we go back to our basic principles of marine mammal welfare, we don't want to make the welfare of an already sick highly stressed animal, even worse. We don't want to have that negative impact, particularly if that wow is in the process of dying. Perhaps we can provide palliative care on the beach and ease its suffering in those last few moments. And so quite often, members of the public who see us when we respond, the stranding seems to slow down rather than we're here, let's move these back into the ocean as quickly as possible. I think a lot of people think that things in the ocean, they need to be in the water like fish and like sharks. They need to, you know, they use their gills to receive oxygen from the water. So they have to be in the water. But with a little bit of knowledge, knowing that whales and dolphins are mammals and they breathe air, there is not the urgency to return them to the ocean. Some people often ask, well, surely their sheer size, where we're working with our bigger animals, you know, our humpback whales, if they come up, or our sperm whales, they need the support of the water around them for their internal organs to function efficiently and properly. Otherwise, their own weight will actually crush and injure their organs. And there is, particularly for those larger species, there's definitely a risk of that. However, I've been involved with a refloat of an 18-meter long sperm whale that successfully survived stranding. And so it is event specific sometimes what the outcomes are as a result of that. So yeah, it's not that to provide the first help, to get assistance and the correct assistance to the beach, that's fast. We want to get there fast. But then once we're there, it's then about providing the right amount of care. It's not about returning the whale or dolphin to the water as quickly as possible.
And I guess for you, you've seen and managed a lot of strandings, but for someone, member of the public who stumbles across what you're doing, I can imagine that coming with a lot of excitement, a lot of fear, a lot of emotions bubbling up that we have to get this done straight away because this is new to my life, whereas just because it's exciting to them doesn't necessarily mean that that's the best approach either.
No, that's right. Now, that excitement that people bring to a stranding can be quite difficult to manage at times. And often our role, once we've stabilized and we've managed and we're assessing the health and the welfare of the whales and the dolphins, quite often then our work turns to engaging with members of the public, answering those questions, providing advice and guidance. And if we need them to help us, is giving them the right information. And I like to call it guide from the side. It was a phrase coined a few years ago. We like to step in there and work with people for those best outcomes. Our marine mammal medic training course is about 4.5 hours in the classroom, and not once do we mention the phrase common sense, because often a lot of the advice we give is counterintuitive. Oh, you don't want to rush them back into the ocean as quickly as possible. Oh, okay. Oh, that's goes counter to what is expected. And often what's expected is shaped by what's reported on the news. And often the news will cut an 8-hour event into 35 seconds of footage. And so people think these events run very quickly.
So let's say I am a member of the public. I'm on my morning walk along the beach and I discover a stranded whale or dolphin. What should I do if I'm the first person on the scene? And are there any particular do's and don'ts to keep in mind?
The very first thing we want you to do is call for help. Now, if you have no phone signal or you've left your phone at home, then what I would like you to do is to pour some water all over the whale. And then depending on the beach, you can write in the sand, gone for help, and the time that you went for help, and then go and make that phone call. That is the best thing you can do in that situation.
Who do I call?
Yes, excellent question. Here in New Zealand, you can phone one of three people. You can phone Project Jonah. We have a 24-hour stranding hotline, and that's 0800 494 253 or 0800 4-WHALE. We will take your details and we will provide you the next step to do. It's simply one way that you can help. So we will give you a little bit of guidance. And then what we will do is we will start mobilizing a response. Now, one of the steps for mobilizing that response is we will talk to the Department of Conservation. Now, you can phone the Department of Conservation as well. And their phone number is 0800 DOC HOT. pop it in your phone and it says, you will get through to a general hotline for the Department of Conservation. So we will be liaising with the department and we'll be assessing what help is required based on the information we've got, and then we'll be forming a plan together. Now, if you panic and you can't remember either of those numbers, you can phone emergency services 111, ask for police. Police will take your details, and then as soon as they hang up from you, they will phone Project Jonah or Doc. But there's three ways of getting help to you.
Okay, so Project Jonah, Doc, or the police.
Exactly.
Yep. All right.
So once, I guess, we made that phone call and got our first initial instructions and you talk to Doc, or Doc talk to you if it's depending on who we call, what happens next?
So then a response will be being mobilized. And so the Project Jonah side of things, what a response looks like, we want to get you some support as quickly as we can. So through the years, since the mid-1980s, when we've been running our marine mammal medic training course for any adult over the age of 15 who wants to do our training, we've trained over 5,200 people across the whole of New Zealand. So what we will do is immediately after we have spoken to the Department of Conservation and you, we will then be doing a database extract. We'll be looking for the nearest medics to where you are. And we will pull that information out. We have a web-to-text system. And what we will do is, depending on how many people we have got, we will be perhaps sending a text out to 50 people. It's very simple. It's as easy as sending one text, but on your computer, we will send a text out, stranding in Tauranga, are you able to assist? And then we only want to hear from people who are able to assist. Now, on a Wednesday morning at 10 o'clock in the morning, a lot of people are going to be at work, but there will be some people who are still available. So we only want to hear from them. Then when we hear from them, we will reach out to them directly and we'll give them specific instructions and they will then be mobilizing. They will have a pre-prepared grab bag with basic equipment for them to assist you, but also, more importantly, with equipment to look after themselves throughout the day. And they will be en route to you. Now, we will give you some very basic advice while that support is mobilizing to you. So a stranded whale, the number one thing you want to do with a stranded whale is we want to keep them cool in body temperature, because as soon as they're out of the water, they will start to heat up internally. Physiologically, they're almost identical to you or I, and their core body temperature needs to be within that 36 to 37 degrees Celsius range for all their heart and liver and lungs all to operate fully. But when they're out of the water, they do start to heat up. And One of the more frequently occurring reasons an otherwise healthy whale or dolphin might die when stranded on the beach is from heat stroke or heat exhaustion. It is literally overheating. And so if we can remove that risk, we can pour water on their body, anywhere over their body, pour that water. The only way you can hurt a whale or a dolphin by pouring water on it is pouring water down the blowhole. So wait until a whale takes a breath. Once it takes a breath, it has a muscular flap of skin over that blowhole that's waterproof. Once it's taken a breath, then pour water over the head and then stop and wait for it to breathe again. And the only other piece of advice I will give you is don't go near the tail. Don't step over or lean over the tail. The tail of a whale or a dolphin is incredibly powerful. The power is in the upstroke. They lift their tails up and down to move through the ocean. I've known people be knocked out, unconscious on the beach at a stranding. I've seen people with broken arms, broken legs by being hit by a tail. And so injuries often occur at strandings before any of the authorities arrive. So before we're able to get there or before the Department of Conservation is able to get there, because people don't take this serious enough. A whale is stuck on the beach. It can't move anywhere, but it can still stretch its muscles. And there's only really two ways you can see them do that. One is opening and closing of its mouth, and the other one is lifting its tail up and down. Let's not forget that, I think one of the fastest whales is one of the biggest whales. I think between the sei whales and the fin whales, it's pretty close, but they can move at 20 to 30 knots or more in the ocean. And that's a whale that weighs upwards of 40 tons, and it's able to do that just by lifting its tail up and down. So it's an incredibly powerful muscle. And there's a fact for you. The muscles of a blue whale, They are about 20 meters long. They are the largest mussels in nature.
What? 20 meters? Far out.
Yeah, from the base of the skull to the tip of the tail, underneath the back, the skin there, there's two mussels that run there along the length of the spine.
Wow.
You know, you definitely don't want to get near that. I feel like that's a very horrible outcome, even if you're there with your best intentions.
That's right.
So you've mentioned the marine mammal medics a few times now that you are training as part of Project Jonah. So what does having this trained community mean for marine mammal conservation here in New Zealand?
So it makes an incredible difference. New Zealand is quite a geographically spread out country. We're long and narrow, and we've got a lot of coastline, and we've got a relatively small population. We're about the same geographical size as Japan. Japan's got a population up, you know, in excess of 80 million. We've got a population of around 6 million. And so having people trained up and down the country, and during our summer months, we run every third or fourth weekend or so, we run a training course up and down the country. We're hoping to train as many people, you know, in as diverse as places as possible, so that in the future, when we do reach out for a stranding, if we have a stranding somewhere, say Timaru, which is halfway between Dunedin and Christchurch, that we do have people who are either in Timaru or close by, one of the many towns between Dunedin and Christchurch, because, you know, somebody receives a mobilized message from us, you know, it might take them 15, 20 minutes to get their gear together, get in the car and get to the beach to support you. But that's almost 2.5 hours. And so by training more and more people around the country to become volunteer marine mammal medics, when we do reach out and they are available, what that does is that gives the people who have discovered the whale the support they need to have the best positive outcome. And it gives us as a network, as a group, the best chance to then assess the health of the stranded whale or dolphin and then make the best welfare decision we can. Hopefully that means returning it to the ocean for it to live out the rest of its natural life.
Yeah, right. I mean, the value of having more people in more diverse places is, I guess, when that once in a however often occurrence comes up, they're able to put their hand up and say, yes, I'm available. But speaking to something you said just before about assessing the wellness of the marine mammal, how do you assess whether a marine mammal can be rescued and should be refloated and returned, or if they can't and the following actions to be taken?
So we're looking for physical signs, and those physical signs can be how the whale or the dolphin actually looks. And we're looking for signs of perhaps emaciation, so that, you know, it hasn't been feeding well, it hasn't fed for a long time. That could be because of illness. It could be because it's swallowed something that it shouldn't have swallowed. Its throat is blocked and it's unable to feed. We're also looking for, you know, signs of frequency of breathing, so stress levels in the moment. So it really is a case of, in fact, a really good diagnostic tool of late that we've started using is WhatsApp, a video phone call of a whale or dolphin that's stranded on the beach, and simply, you know, having someone hold their phone, filming the animal, walking up and down the length of it. We can then get that without having somebody on the ground checking. We can then gather that information. And then what we can do is Project Jonah sits on a global stranding experts panel. And that's another exciting WhatsApp group that we have a privilege of being on. But that is a network of global experts who we can reach out to at any time. So depending on the species, depending on which expert might be available around the world to take a look at this video and then help us with diagnostics if it's something that we're not familiar with as well. So literally, you know, as soon as you've made that phone call, it might be that we simply say to you, right, go back to the whale. Can you put your WhatsApp on? Call me on WhatsApp and let's take a look at this whale or dolphin. And so very quickly, we can diagnose whether this is a candidate for refloat or not.
Wow.
That's amazing. I love how interconnected it is and that you have the opportunity of speaking to an expert when you need to.
Just through WhatsApp.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so cool.
So if it's a candidate for refloating, what are the next steps that need to occur for that to happen?
So then it's about having the right equipment, and it's having ideally the right people there on the beach. However, every stranding is different. That's a bit of a cliche in our work. Genuinely, every stranding is different. And so depending on the availability of people, the availability of equipment, sometimes we have to be creative with what we've got. So if it is a single dolphin that has stranded, we've taken a look at it, we've assessed it, it's in good physical health, it's breathing regularly, we've managed its stress levels, then it's a case of, well, we could wait for the tide to return, but the tide has just left it on the beach 2 hours ago. So we're waiting for 10 more hours. Well, with a dolphin, I know with 6, 8, maybe even 10 people and the right piece of equipment, we could safely, without injuring the dolphin or without injuring any people, we could safely lift and return that dolphin to the water. So we don't have to wait for the tide to come back in. We can then do that with that right equipment and that right technique. If it is a mass stranding of pilot whales, something we learned in those early days was that you don't take an individual and refloat that single whale. You could have 12 people trying to lift a 4 meter long, maybe 2 ton whale, trying to lift that and move that back into the ocean. Often what happens is that one whale is then free swimming, but then all it will do is simply turn around and re-strand. Now, that's often a sign of an underlying health issue, but knowing that the rest of its pod, the rest of its family is there behind you on the beach, it's not going to leave its pod behind. It's going to stay with its pod. And so rather than put all the effort into floating the whales one at a time, the key is to refloat a mass stranding, particularly of pilot whales, all at the same time. We need that. The pod, they stranded together, so we want to refloat them all together. And so your best time to do that is at that next high tide.
Right. Wow, that's really fascinating. It really depends on the situation you're in.
And what an effort as well, if it is a mass stranding. That's amazing. Oh.
Yeah. So I really take my hat off to the work that you do. But I'm thinking we're at the stranding event. There's lots going on. Some are surviving, some are passing away. Lots of volunteers around, lots of activity. What kind of data do you collect from these events and how do you use this data?
So a stranding response is actually a great collaborative moment. So we will be there, Department of Conservation will be there. And then depending on the scale of the event, so if it is a mass stranding, chances are one of our research institutions will be there as well. And so here in New Zealand, the primary research institutions are Massey University, either out of Auckland or out of Palmerston North. You've got University of Auckland, Canterbury University as well. So between those three research institutions, sometimes there are some specialisms in Dunedin as well, but they will be the ones who may well be gathering samples, who may well be gathering more information physically from any whales or dolphins, dead or alive. Department of Conservation, we will assist them in gathering specific information, whether that's photographs for a whale or a dolphin. It's the dorsal fin that's usually the individual identifier, almost like a fingerprint of you and I. And for very large species, it's the tail flukes. And there are databases of these photographs. Some are held privately, some are held by University of Auckland, actually has the largest catalogue of samples and photographs here in New Zealand. And so, you know, we will assist with that work. We won't specifically be gathering that work, that information ourselves. There are, you know, we aren't a scientific institution, but there are institutions that we will assist with that. When we want to gather samples from marine mammals, for physical samples, whether that's for DNA, whether that is for toxicology or other information, then here in New Zealand, Tangata Whenua, Māori, will play an essential role throughout all stages of a stranding. And so we will be looking to work closely with the local iwi or hapu, and sometimes there's multiple iwi involved depending on where we are. And we will always be taking samples with the permission and the support of local iwi. Whales and dolphins have incredible cultural significance to Tangata Whenua here in New Zealand. I've met some people who we call it whakapapa, they hold whales within their ancestral history. And so if there is a whale or dolphin on the beach, you know, they see that almost, you know, that's an equivalent of an ancestor being there on the beach, dead or alive. And so with that framing, we are always responding to a stranding, knowing that there may be people in attendance at the stranding, seeing these people as, you know, representations, seeing the whales and dolphins, sorry, as representations of pretty much of people.
Right. That's a really interesting point.
So I'm going to be a bit mean now and ask the question. Is there any way to predict those stranding events, or do they always come as a surprise?
Oh, wouldn't that be wonderful if we could predict them? We'd be there on the beach getting ready. You say it's on the 25th?
I've got my coffee in hand.
To a greater or lesser degree, it might be possible to predict them. We know historically that they occur quite often at Farewell Spit in Northland, on Stewart Island, on the Chatham Islands, speaking just of New Zealand. They also happen quite often, but very different species, and single strandings in the Mahia Peninsula out at between Hawke's Bay and Gisborne. But they can happen any time of year. Historically, if we go back over our stranding database, some of the data gathered is the frequency and the statistics of strandings. And the Department of Conservation does hold a stranding database of over 100 years of solid information. Historically, it does show that strandings occur more frequently during the summer months. And so anything from, I'd say, November all the way through to, say, March or April, historically, we're likely to have more strandings than other times of year. And that coincides with warmer coastal waters, that coincides with more food availability, and then that coincides with more species visiting our shores. However, last few years, that predictability, as useful as it is, it's pretty much, it's not happening anymore. The predictability isn't there anymore. And you know, speaking to our peers, speaking to scientists, and it's simply down to warming oceans. And our warming oceans, as a result of anthropogenic climate change, we're seeing everything, in the food web is changing. When and where food is available and appearing, that is then having that impact on where species are likely to be. And any predictability there were, that is gone, sadly. The only other thing that has been observed, particularly with our pilot whales, is some pre-stranding behaviour. It's often unusual to see, but it has been seen a number of times. And often what this is a pod of pilot whales coming in very close to shore, often just to pass the breakers. And this pod of whales will literally be on top of each other. You won't be able to tell one whale from the next. They'll be so tightly in a mass. If you've ever seen a really tight bait ball in the ocean of fish, well, imagine that factored out with whales that are 4 to 6 meters long, and you've got 50, 80, 100 or more all in this mass. And they will do this for several hours or more, maybe anything from 6 to maybe 18 hours. But then there's a moment in time where the whales all at once turn and they swim through the breakers and strand on the beach. There was a very famous case of this. We didn't know until after it had happened. It was on the south coast of Australia towards Perth, and this mass of pilot whales was seen, and there was some incredible drone footage taken and then published through social media. But by the time it was published, the whales had turned, swum through the waves and swum up onto the beach. If we had known sooner, then we could have provided the advice that has worked when it has been seen here in New Zealand, to create disturbance, get in there. And actually, we're using sound, using boats, revving and splashing, harass the whales off into deeper water. Because then, having seen this pre-stranding behavior, then there is the opportunity to prevent the mass stranding from occurring. But that depends on observing that mass huddling behavior. We were lucky, it's possibly October, late October 2023, there were around 40 pilot whales came into a very shallow bay on Kauau Island in the Hariki Gulf. And early action meant that we were able to mobilize people onto the water. And these were people in kayaks. In fact, it was a school group of year 12s who were at the local camp. They went out in kayaks, created disturbance. And what actually came to play out was that one whale was close to death, and that whale did die in the shallows. But about between 2 to 4 hours after that whale dying, the pod turned, and actually with the encouragement of the team in the kayaks, actually left the bay and went back out and swam out to deeper water and didn't strand. So there are some things we can do if we're aware of these things, these factors.
Wow. So, yeah, I'm really curious why these pilot whales come into balls and swim just beyond the breakers or just outside of where they're stranding. Is there solid science on that, or is that something we're still not sure on?
No, we don't know why. We can only make suppositions, if you like. We can only think about what might lead them to that, and it could well be a stress response. The stress, what is the stress they're responding to? It could be the stress of, again, predation. So it's a herding instinct, safety in numbers. The tighter you are in a group, then the less likely is one of you is going to be picked off from a predator. It could be there's other disturbance. There could be loud noise in the ocean, noise that we're either making or we're unaware of that could be leading to this behavior as well. Or it could simply be that, similar to a human, if we've got a sick relative who's in the hospital, we flock to them, we gather to them. And it could be that that is what we've seen play out. Those really tight social bonds have brought those whales all in together to each other.
Yeah, right.
And I guess we know, right, the more we find out about whales and dolphins, that they do have or seem to have what we could describe as a culture. So I feel like that would make total sense, all that you just said.
How many strandings happen in New Zealand each year on average? And is there anything that we as Kiwis can do to reduce that number?
Probably on average is about 300 strandings a year.
Wow.
It's one of the highest frequencies, you know, considering New Zealand's size. You know, it's one of the highest frequencies of strandings anywhere in the world. A lot of those are the beach cast single whales, so whales or dolphins that have died at sea and then have come to shore and then wash up on the shore. But of course, we do have our mass strandings as well. And it is approximately, you know, it's at least 300 individuals involved in these events each year as well. But it only takes one large event for that data to be skewed even higher. So yeah, we do have a lot of strandings. And again, if it's a live stranding, that quick call for assistance is key to a greater chance of a positive outcome for those live stranded whales. That make that phone call to authorities. I can't say that enough.
And is there any, like, okay, once it's stranded, a quick phone call is the best thing, but is there anything we can control to reduce the amount that actually show up on our shores in the first place?
There's several things people can do to perhaps minimise the chances of strandings occurring. Some strandings, as I say, they are as a result of interactions with vessels. So if you are operating a vessel, if you are operating a jet ski or a similar fast vessel, there's foiling yachts, which are becoming more and more popular as well. You know, a foiling yacht that's traveling at 40 knots is going to be very hard for a whale or a dolphin to avoid because they cannot hear it approaching them. So awareness of what's around you and awareness of your legal responsibility when you are on the water. Let's not forget that if you are operating a vessel on the water, you hold some degree of responsibility for the vessel and the people on it. But you also have in law a responsibility for your interactions with marine mammals. So be aware of what your responsibilities are around those, because seeing a propeller strike on a dolphin is horrific. And to see that actually just through a little bit less speed or a little bit awareness of what's around in the ocean and actually being aware of not going through a pod of dolphins, actually follow the pod of dolphins at a respectable distance and observe, is going to be a much more enjoyable experience for the boat operator and the people on the boat, and of course for the dolphin that they might strike. I mean, I could say things like, you know, consider what you eat, because, you know, the saying there's plenty more fish in the sea, we're seeing actually more and more reports of, whether it's from individuals who are struggling to catch fish, you know, recent reports saying that the Hauraki Gulf is almost extinct of fish species is incredibly sad. And it's human consumption that has driven areas of the ocean to become dead zones almost. And so, yeah, we have the opportunity to choose what we eat, whether it is sea-based, whether it is land-based, whether it is, you know, air-based, you know, any of those opportunities are there. And so, you know, whales dolphins don't have the opportunity to change their diets up when the fish aren't around for them to consume. And also, I mean, we see whales and dolphins, we see them, sometimes they're stranded, and if the opportunity to conduct a necropsy, so that is the equivalent of a human autopsy, if there is the opportunity, particularly if a whale or a dolphin is seen to be malnourished, it has been seen, and there have been some famous reported stories of whales and dolphins consuming plastics, thinking that they are food in the ocean. And there's some very famous photos of plastic single-use bags in the ocean looking very much like jellyfish. And so, yeah, these will accumulate in the bodies of whales and dolphins, and they don't get passed through. And so what they'll do is eventually the whale or dolphin's stomach and throat and gullet will become blocked. They'll no longer be able to feed. And that can have a direct impact on the potential survival of that whale or dolphin. So again, you know, be a tidy Kiwi is a phrase that all of us have lived by for decades. Well, let's not stop being tidy Kiwis. And, you know, if you do see any plastic on the beach, then, you know, let's pick it up and pop it in the bin and take it home.
Yeah. So it's really, really the basics. Get them right and we're good. We're off to the races. What if we look forward and we jump in our proverbial time machine and Project Jonah is now in 10 years in the future or 50 years in the future, what does a successful outcome look like?
Well, if we say 50 years in the future, I mean, it's interesting because if we go back in time 50 years and look at where we were, you know, there were calls for commercial whaling to be restarted here in New Zealand. And of course, my worry is that in future years, we may need to start that work back up again, because if the populations of whales and dolphins do start bouncing back, well, a 40-ton whale does hold a lot of protein. And so if there is pressure on food and our populations continue to grow globally, then there may be a potential renaissance of commercial whaling. Now, we haven't worked this hard for that to all be undone through the need of humanity, particularly poorer countries. I mean, we do live in a rather privileged position to be able to say don't eat whales, whereas there are third world countries who perhaps, you know, they need that protein to feed their population. So that's a worry for me, that our work in continuing to ensure that commercial whaling doesn't return. If we're looking at whales and dolphins themselves, I hope they are able to adapt to their environment changing and their environment shifting. We may see populations start to become displaced from their traditional areas. And so an example here in New Zealand is at Kaikoura. There is a semi-resident population of sperm whales, and they live in Kaikoura because of those exact conditions are perfect for them to learn to become adult sperm whales. However, if the ocean does start warming and the food chain shifts, then it's quite possible we're going to be seeing populations like those sperm whales moving south to cooler waters. And so, I mean, I have no doubt that we are in this, we are on the cusp of a lot of changes within the marine environment. I hope in 50 years' time, we are able to still talk about marine mammals in the present context as well. And with my most positive hat on, I hope that you know, we're in this early time of artificial intelligence, and artificial intelligence is being used for lots of different things at the moment. But I'm hoping that perhaps with artificial intelligence, we may actually be able to start deciphering the sounds and communication of marine mammals. And if that's the case, then perhaps not only can we hear what they're saying, but does that become a two-way thing? And then actually we can maybe, if you could understand what the needs were of a species, what does that look like?
That would be cool. It just reminds me of Finding Nemo with Dory. You know, do you speak whale?
If only it was that easy.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing those insights. And I was also just thinking, hey, maybe if we do speak whale, maybe we can tell those pilot whales to be careful in our areas like Fair Whales Bit, where they do seem to strand quite regularly, which would also be quite amazing, really. Kind of moving into prevention.
That's the holy grail, prevention. And there is some work starting to happen around knowing where whales are. And so previously, acoustic buoys have been placed in the ocean. In fact, NIWA did an exercise in the mid-2010s, and they placed 10 acoustic buoys at various different depths in the Cook Strait, and they did record whales, and they were aware of which species, and in fact they also had an unidentified species of whale pass through the Cook Strait. And so those buoys however had to be gathered back in, and then the computers downloaded and had to be then analyzed in a lab. Now we are now in a time where we are able to get live broadcast recordings. And with, again, I mentioned artificial intelligence a few moments ago, if we're able to analyze the calls that we are hearing in real time, we may be able to understand what whales are where. So if we do know, for instance, that a pod of pilot whales have made their way past what's called separation point, that's an area that's about 40 kilometers on the other side of Golden Bay, close to the mass stranding spot, then perhaps we can then make decisions about closer monitoring preparedness before then thinking about the slightly more controversial, we're intervening. You know, is that something we should be doing? Should we actually start to affect their behaviours at that early time? So again, we've got some ethical questions, but we've also got some excitement through technology occurring too.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, my ideas brain is just going off with all the possibilities right now.
Good.
Zooming out a bit, conservation has different meanings to everyone. We all have a different view of what it means to do conservation, to be a conservationist. What does conservation mean to you, Darren?
Conservation for me is I think if we could all understand our impacts, direct or indirect, on all of the environments that we operate in, if we are able to spend time in them and observe and not necessarily interact, but to see and understand, then we can then choose how we want that. We can choose how we interact with that environment. And so whether it is the marine environment, or if you're, you know, you like the mountains, you like hiking in the bush, you know, think about those environments and then think about, well, how could you have a positive impact on that? So is it here in New Zealand, for example, walking a trap line once every couple of weeks? You know, is it tree planting? Is it picking up litter when you go to the beach? Is it volunteering with Project Jonah and learning more how to become a marine mammal medic? Or is it, you know, is it encouraging your friends? Or is it, it's knowing your impacts and then choosing how you respond to that. And if you're choosing to act in a positive way for nature, then I believe that's true conservation.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a beautiful answer. I love that. So you already mentioned volunteering for Project Jonah right now. So how can people get involved and support your work?
Well, yeah, there's several ways. If you just want to observe the work we're doing, then we are on the main social media channels. So you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and also on LinkedIn. So you can observe from afar the work we do, in particular with regards to our work with strandings. We do post regularly on Facebook during a stranding. Or you can support us in many different ways. I've mentioned doing the Marine Mammal Medic course. Then you're more than welcome. Dates are available on our website. We train, as I say, during the summer months, and that for us is kind of October to April. Or, you know, we are a very small charity with a nationwide remit. As I said, I may have said earlier, we're 2.5 full-time staff with the whole country as our office at times. And so being a charity, we do rely on donations from members of the public and support from businesses and then from trust and grant bodies as well. So if you are able to support our work in any way, a small regular monthly financial gift allows us to better plan and better prepare, particularly for those unexpected, as we aren't able to predict when our strandings occur, and we have those costs that are incurred in attending a stranding. So if you are able to help in any way, it helps us mobilize better, mobilize quicker. And look, it also helps with our education, you know, going into schools. We don't charge schools to to visit. So we always do that. We do that for free. We don't want finances to be a barrier for children to learn about the marine environment. So our education outreach into schools is there for all schools to enjoy.
Yeah, awesome. I think there's some really good ways to get involved there, and a dollar put into protecting marine mammals is a dollar well spent, I say. So lovely. It's been a really awesome time learning from you and chatting with you on this podcast, Darren. I've certainly learned a lot, and yeah, I hope our audience does too. So thanks so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, lovely. Well, nga mihi nui.
Thank you. Kia ora, Darren.
Cheers.
Kia ora. Cheers.